Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 558th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And in the last few podcasts, we've done topics that we've never talked about. And we're going to continue that with this.
We're going to continue on that vein, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the condition we've talked a lot about. But
yeah, we're going to talk about depression, but we're going to talk about some novel kind of ideas for depression.
Yeah. So, and always when I hear novel, I assume that they must work exceedingly effectively.
Yeah, so that's right. So there's an expectation that they do. And anything that's new obviously works good. This is also... we're going to talk about ketamine and psilocybin. So one of those is derived from a natural product. Ketamine is used for a variety of things, started out in veterinary medicine, then became used as an anesthetic, mm-hmm. and also a recreational drug.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it. And there's some level of enthusiasm when a product moves from something used recreationally to something potentially with therapeutic benefit for a known condition. There's kind of a...
I found it fascinating. Like,
yeah, it is. It is a really interesting thing. And there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And who knows, there could be kind of people with testimonials like, you know, I was depressed and I used ketamine at a rave party, which is kind of what they're frequently associated with. Mm-hmm. And I felt better for a long time afterwards and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I think that, and then there's, of course, Big Brother who's hiding this information in the minds of many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of kind of narratives that can be wove into this that make us... That really generate a lot of interest.
Yeah, and as you know, there's lots of sort of media reports about this, and I think that's where a lot of this sort of starts, right?
Right. So the media kind of gloms onto these things because they want a story, mm-hmm. and the best story is one with controversy. Where there's conflict. So that's kind of the ideal, or one where you can captivate people with these narratives that we've discussed. This is a drug that's used recreationally, but now we're finding these uses, and you know, and as you know, from our work with Dr. Oz and others, that use of certain terms is very powerful, but mm-hmm. quite popular. So words like unlocking, it works like magic in the brain. It's mm-hmm. a lifeline. These are the kind of words that are used to describe the activities of ketamine. And there's testimonials, of course, that lifted me out of depression and, you know, saved my life, all of this kind of things. And there's pseudoscience to it. It stabilized the brain in a well state. What does that mean?
Well, it's never happened to me.
Oh, you started out in an unwell state and have never actually
never a stabilized state. But yeah, no, it's really interesting because, as you know, we may get into a little bit of this. I mean, ketamine is basically a version of PCP or angel dust. So,
right,
you know,
right.
you know, it's, so it, it is not, it doesn't have the greatest track record of therapeutic benefit.
Some of the psychiatrists around the Freudian they were experimenting with a lot of these products, and who knows, maybe their data was hidden. That might be something for a grad student.
Yeah, because you kind of, I always find it funny. We've got a drug that makes you hallucinate, might precipitate violent behavior. You'll hear weird things. You'll likely pass out. I wonder if it works for this.
it's interesting, right? So there must be something that leads. There's all sorts of stories about where the ideas come from, the innovations for trying them for certain conditions. Like the whole idea of, as you know, sildenafil was initially used to treat pulmonary hypertension. And the rumor is the male participants in the clinical trial came back and said, I don't really know if my walking distance is any better, but I'll tell you what.
Yeah, I'll tell you what is better.
And it's the same for things like minoxidil. And things like that. So we kind of coincidentally discover some of the additional benefits of drugs. And so ketamine may have followed that path. I really don't know how it came.
No.
But let's go back. And then, of course, one of the other things that I find fascinating is, you know, testimonials of celebrities to somehow justify or to make sense of the use of these products. And one of them around ketamine was a quote from Elon Musk that he microdoses ketamine for major depression. I mean,
yeah,
he might make a good car, but that doesn't mean that he's any, and obviously with the recent things that he's been doing, it's even any level of admiration for him should be long out the door. Yeah. But
it might explain a lot of things though.
Yeah, it might explain his microdoses of ketamine. It might actually, you're totally right. It might explain
And you're saying, you're talking about the celebrities, but you know, there are, I know there's some information about what opinion leaders, because I think sometimes people think opinion leaders are celebrities, or maybe opinion leaders think they are celebrities.
But yeah, so that's where this, so let's talk a little bit about a study that leads us into this. This is from the British Journal of Psychiatry. And this was published literally this summer. You'll find when we talk about this, so many of these articles are from the last kind of summer. And I was finding it hard to keep up with the literature because one, I'd summarize something and literally 2 weeks later, another study would come out that, you know, would augment or even disagree with the results. But this one was from the summer. And the authors looked at 40 different newspaper sites across the United States, the UK, Canada, and Australia. And they were a handful of magazines and newspaper sites, and they tried to look at 10 at each, and they were looking for articles that mentioned ketamine. They found 119 of them. And what they found was that research was mentioned. It wasn't just gobbledygook. Just over 90% of the time, research was mentioned. 57% of the time they quoted the results, so they actually had results. And 76% of the time, though, it was positive. The result, it was presented in a positive way. And efficacy was talked about three times more than safety.
Yeah. Having news reports mention research is not necessarily always done by any stretch of the
imagination. No, that's what's surprising. So 90%. As mentioned, if you looked at the overall article, just over 2/3 were positive. Some of them were mixed. If you put the mixed and positive together, it came up to almost 90%, and only 10% were negative. And 90% of the articles also had quotes from key opinion leaders. And these are people who provide ketamine infusions for depression. Leaders in psychiatry, for example, perhaps even people who own companies that are relevant to this. And 62% of the time, they were only positive. 24% they were mixed. Again, if you add that up, it approaches 90. And only 6% of the key opinion leaders were negative. And here's what's really fascinating to me. 37% of the articles had errors in them. Mm-hmm. And out of that 37%, 25%, in other words, the majority, it was the key opinion leaders that the quotes from the key opinion leaders that had wrong information.
Yeah. Well, you know as well as I do that, one, just because you're an opinion leader doesn't mean you know much about evidence.
No.
Or interpretation of it, or correctly talking about it. And if you believe something really does work, you will likely, as it almost says, you're going to say the positive things. And so, yeah. And I mean, it may not be 100% it could be the fault of the reporter. It could be a whole bunch of other things, but it's still an issue.
Yeah, for sure. It's an issue. Yeah. So it's just important to remember that key opinion leaders, and that's why, and I say when I give this talk and other talks, is why people like you and I and others in the peer group, et cetera, often get tapped on the shoulders to look at these controversial topics, is because I think some of our colleagues are desperate for something that doesn't, a viewpoint or a look at the evidence that doesn't come in with a bias ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I think you're like me. I would love it if ketamine or psilocybin worked like a hot damn and had no side effects.
Yeah, we're not that horrible people that we think that we just want everything to not work very well.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not coming in at it from that side either, coming at it from, I'm just trying to find out.
No.
Like, you know, I'm trying to bring down this drug and all the people who support it. It's not that. I actually, and that's where the term, you know, I don't care, but I use the joke in this case, you know, the old expression, say no to drugs. Well, we're saying perhaps to drugs because, we, you know, let's read the evidence and see what it's showing and also reflect on what are the limits and what's happening out there with conversations around these.
But Mike, we're actually saying say no to drugs, K-N-O-W.
Nice.
I know.
Nice. How long had you been working on that?
Well, actually, about 25 years ago, we made a whole bunch of t-shirts that said that. So.
Nicely done.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then the only other comment is, you know, and when you do media and you are almost always able to find an opinion leader.
Oh,
but often
sure.
it may only be one or two.
Yeah.
It's not like,
no,
Yeah,
and what's fascinating is, and because you've done a lot of media, and I've done more than enough for me to be satisfied to never need to do it again. the media, there may be 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100 healthcare providers who are on one side.
Mm-hmm.
They will interview one of them.
Yeah.
They will interview the one person on the other side, and it gets about the same amount of space in the media coverage.
Yeah.
And even though it's fringe, it gets the same amount of coverage. And that's one of the very maddening things for
me. And I agree. And then it sounds balanced because we're looking at both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. We're looking at both sides, even though we could only find one person in, you know, Canada who actually believes this.
Yeah, yeah.
We did get their opinion and put it in.
But, you know, we really shouldn't just complain for the next 20 minutes. We should.
No, we should. Let's move on. Because we talked about the challenges of the media, but that's our foundation of our knowledge until we dig deeper. So where would I go next? Well, I decided to go to places like UpToDate, which we don't need to talk about, and guidelines, which we do need to talk about. We're going to talk about, there are other guidelines. The U.S. has a guideline about ketamine, which we'll talk about towards the end. But let's start with Canada's guideline for ketamine, which was published in 2021. Now, the CANMAT guidelines, you and I have had, I would say, soft runs at some of their guidelines before. One of the things that we're always, I would say, frustrated with, there is good stuff in there, but we're frustrated with the fact that they don't worry enough about conflicts of interest. So I did look at this one, and out of 20 authors on this guideline, 16 had relevant conflicts of interest, including the chair.
Yeah.
And that's 80%.
And that's even by that perspective, that's high, period. You know, it doesn't matter what guideline, that's pretty, you got to work pretty hard to get that.
Yeah. And there is no standard that I'm aware of that goes beyond an acceptance of 50% and none for the chair.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the most lenient of all of the rules that I've ever seen around guidelines. So that this is firmly on the other side of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an almost conflicts of interest be damned, we're charging ahead kind of thing. And there was no mention of how they managed conflicts either, if they would exclude people from voting. No, but
it may be impossible, because maybe the only people who really think it works are the people who have an interest in it, because this is not mainstream.
No, it's not. So and then one of the things that always interests me in these is, what's your justification apart from the clinical trial evidence. What's the logic, if you will, of how it works? Now, please, this is your chance, James, to take a shot at me as I engage in the mechanism of action.
I have been waiting for you not to take a shot at you. I just want to hear you do something about mechanism of action. So go fill your boots with it.
So if you're courageous enough to read around this and enough, you'll see at least 10 theories of why ketamine is working. And the list goes on. I'm going to give you a couple quotes, which I think are interesting. And they're direct quotes from the article. Ketamine causes a burst of glutamate release, a sustained synaptogenesis of depression-related neural circuits dependent on an increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor and protein synthesis. Now, you're probably swimming a bit with that. Suffice to say, it's fine if you don't remember anything I just said, because that was made up. We don't know how it's working, and we certainly don't know how it would target specifically depression-related neural circuits. It's fascinating to me that we can imply some level of, I would go beyond physiology here to magic.
Mm-hmm. And it just sort of reminds me, we probably shouldn't teach people Latin and words that require them to say these sorts of things, because it's a problem.
It's a problem like this. And it goes on to list other ways. So ketamine acts on other neurotransmitters like dopaminergic, serotonergic, cholinergic, mm-hmm. as well as opioid receptors and so on. And there's all sorts of big fancy word, hydroxyneuroketamine, a metabolite of R-ketamine to A-amino-3-hydroxy, etc. I'm not going to list the name. But there's a bunch of proposed mechanisms here. And as an orthopedic surgeon, a friend of mine once said to me, Mike, if there's more than one surgery, that means we don't know what one works. If there's more than one surgery for the same problem. So I thought, if we're describing all of these mechanisms, that means we really don't know. There are two proposed mechanisms by which ketamine might work, and these have actually received at least minimal testing. So let's talk about those. So one is through the NMDA, so that's N-methyl-D-aspartate, and that's in combination with kind of glutamate as well. Now, it's important to realize that other drugs that have been tried to affect this pathway haven't been found to be successful, but we're going to discuss it anyway, because it's still a proposed mechanism mm-hmm. of action for ketamine. And this was a study of healthy people, which is important because when you're healthy, how can you make you less depressed? It's difficult. Yeah. So that's a challenge. But what they did in this is give lamotrigine to these people as these 16 people. They gave half lamotrigine and half placebo. And then they gave half of those, so this is kind of now you could get lamotrigine plus ketamine or placebo again, or placebo plus ketamine and placebo again. In this study, what they found is that, well, lamotrigine attenuated some of the kind of dissociative symptoms that come with ketamine and kind of some of the psychosis type symptoms, it didn't actually stop it. So it's working by more, the suggestion is it's working by more than just this NMDA pathway. There's, of course, no way to measure how well it worked on mood because they didn't test, they tested it in healthy people, so you can't really tell.
Yeah.
But it does raise the question of is this at all how it's working when it doesn't fully stop the effect. So we don't, if it is working by that pathway, it's not working wholly by that pathway. The second study looked at even less people, but this time it looked at symptomatic people. These are severe depression patients. Generally, these people have a MADRS score in the high 20s, many of them who are studied, and we'll talk about that a little more. And they were given ketamine versus plus or minus naltrexone. Why would they do that? Well, there's a concern among a number of people that ketamine may actually be functioning partially or fully through an opioid pathway. Hmm. And because it does hit opioid receptors. That obviously is a big concern given our not so recent history. Another, what I mean by that is a long history of making mistakes with opioids. And so what did they found? Well, they found that the use of naltrexone attenuated the response that people got from ketamine. So the people who got ketamine started out with, you know, a MADRS score somewhere around 28. And if they were, if they got naltrexone, the best their score kind of improved to at 5 days was somewhere around a 19 from 28. But if you got ketamine without naltrexone, you got down to like a 10 score. And if you look at those who met the criteria of response, 5 out of 7 who didn't get naltrexone got there, versus 0 out of 7 on naltrexone. So it's just a signal that there seems to be some functioning through the opioid receptors as well.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that sort of research. I think, you know, it has potential to lead us down hopefully the correct pathway, but you never know.
Identifying it. Now, there are, of course, arguments on both sides that this is reliable, it's not reliable, it doesn't matter, it matters, all of that kind of stuff. But for us, and thinking about it, it should be a signal of concern. So if it's working this way, then what is it actually, could it actually be an even bigger risk, particularly among some subgroups who have had difficulty with substance dependence?
Does it work based on a fairy dust principle? Because we figured that that's how statins work. And I thought, given that this comes from, angel dust, or at least...
It's related as a psychedelic, for sure. So I hadn't gone that route, James. I decided to play this somewhat straight-laced because it's relatively easy to go down those paths.
Yeah,
not that I didn't go there, because I certainly did.
Yeah.
But we often joke that I don't really care how statins work, whether they work via lipids, whether they work as an anti-inflammatory. I just think that they cross the, they get digested and cross into the bloodstream and then automatically convert to fairy dust powder that circles around, cures our arteries. But I don't know. And I think it's just really important for us to understand that we're still, even though the enthusiasm for ketamine is growing, I was just in the United States a little while ago. And at a community fair market, there was a booth advertising, you know, book your ketamine infusion with us today, and they'll set you up in their clinic. So it was just this, it felt very unregulated. You would, of course, never see anything like that in Canada, but that was just, the enthusiasm exceeds it. So I think the next step, after we've kind of talked about the foundation of the guidelines and that kind of piece, it's more getting into the evidence. So, and that's despite the 15 minutes already or more, that's why you all tuned in. So let's talk first about the limits in the evidence, which I think are so important for us to understand. And to do this, I looked over a lot of meta-analysis and systematic reviews, well into the 20s, 30s of them. And just some key things that I think you should be aware of before we start talking about the evidence, because it helps how we interpret it. Ketamine is a drug that's been around a long time. And because it's been around a long time, there is little to no drug industry support to study it. That means that the studies of ketamine are generally going to be short and small and at high risk of biases, because they're run out of small shops that James and I might run in a ward in St. Paul's Hospital, kind of off the side of our desk, putting 10 patients through.
Yeah.
And those studies are at high risk of bias, because if we didn't find something in our 10 patients, we might not even proceed to publication, because we would think that no one would care and it's not as interesting.
Yeah. And it's also, it's not... administering it is not simple.
No, it's not simple at all. We'll talk about the complexity of administering this and psilocybin in a bit. So ketamine is what we're going to see is a bunch of small short studies. And to give you an example of that, when we looked at the Cochrane review, what we found is that, and I looked at another one called, this is by a guy named Baji, and it was in the Expert Opinion Drug Safety Journal. And what they're finding is that 89% of IV ketamine studies are one single dose.
Yeah.
The average duration of follow-up, a median follow-up, is 7 days. Some go less than a day even. And the sizes of the studies are often, the average is 26 patients in a study. Some were as low as 5 patients. So we're really talking about short, small studies of a single dose of intervention. So how does it work long-term? How does it, you know, well, the collection of adverse events will be poor in these small studies, and they won't be able to capture things because they're too short and too small. So,
But there is a belief that, as you know, and I'm going to say something that I don't 1,000% believe in, but antidepressants, you know, are in theory are supposed to take, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to work. They clearly work earlier than that for some symptoms. Yeah.
But, yes, for sure.
Yeah,
the evidence.
But the suggestion is that these work. This drug works specifically, like quite quickly. Like
yeah. But certainly you'll know within 7 days.
Yeah. Which you would not. I don't think you could. I think you'd be hard pressed to say, you know, if you tried fluoxetine for 7 days and you went, oh, it didn't work. To go, oh well, that's obviously it doesn't work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Many people would disagree with that. Although you can't, like, if you had big enough study size, you could prove those who were early responders. You could,
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And then, so because they're small, short studies, publication bias is kind of rampant. And there are three different systematic reviews that have identified the risk of publication bias. And what they found, looking at it in different ways, that if the relative benefit of ketamine over placebo is 114%. So that would mean the relative risk would be 2.14.
Yeah, so close to double.
Yeah. If that's what the baseline is, if you correct for publication bias, it drops by 50% to 1.48. So by correcting for this publication bias, which tells us that the benefits we're seeing with ketamine are almost certainly inflated.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at other markers of quality, like is it an open label RCT? Is it a study without a control group? Is it a crossover study? And if you looked at all of those, the relative benefits are about 50% of looking at the whole collection of evidence is about twice as good as if you just look at the highest quality studies. So this is just a signal to us that when we look at this data, we have to understand that we're seeing some inflation, particularly with ketamine. Now, the other drug, the sister drug of this, the racemic isomer, is S-ketamine. And where almost all the ketamine studies are IV, the S-ketamine studies are almost all intranasal spray, and they're used long-term. They're bigger, and they're funded by the drug industry because it's a new drug coming to market.
Yeah.
James, any thoughts about
it? Yeah, no. So I think it's actually really good of you to talk about the issues before we even get into the evidence. Because
yeah, and I think what's interesting here is people like you and I are often saying things like, the drug industry studies are so bad. In this case, I'm not saying they're good or without a risk of bias, but the small, short ones done without industry funding are actually, they carry a ton of bias too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, for sure.
And if we don't kind of recognize that. So let's just get to what we can say was found. This is from the Cochrane review first.
Mm-hmm.
And Cochrane looked at 5 time points, just as James was suggesting already. These drugs are often looked at early. So 1 day, at 3 days, at 1 week, then at 2 weeks and 4 weeks, often not beyond that. Esketamine has more data that goes beyond, and we'll talk about a few ketamine studies that do, usually giving extra doses. If you compared ketamine versus placebo, there are 4 to 7 RCTs, depending on what time point you look at, with 83 to 185 patients. So if you're like me, you're thinking 83 to 185 patients isn't a lot for an intervention like this. And what they found was that placebo improved things 2 to 9% for patients that would get a response to placebo, would have a response in their depression. That's compared to 18 to 24% more are feeling better with ketamine. And those benefits are really only seen at day 1 and 3. They're not seen at week 1, 2 weeks, or 4 weeks. So it's all front loaded, and it's this kind of small improvement in symptoms.
Yeah.
Or not small improvement, but improvement over placebo of about, you know, 25% or so.
Yeah, which would be the equivalent of what you, when we say response to this medication, we're talking about a typical way that we check response with any of the antidepressants.
Yeah, so that would be a considerable, a large reduction in the MADRS score.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the majority where it's a 50% reduction in MADRS score.
Which, and I think that's a clinically relevant change.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, the problem though is, I mean, with these placebo-controlled trials, it's like what the problem that we ran into with the cannabinoids. How do you placebo control this? Because if you don't know you're on ketamine, my goodness.
Right. We were going to talk about that more. Yeah. And that's drawn out in an RCT that we'll talk about at the end of the ketamine podcast. What James is talking about here is you're giving a drug that virtually everyone can sort out when they're on it. So with psilocybin, for example, it's north of 95% who can tell whether or not they got placebo or a version of placebo or psilocybin. The same is true of ketamine. People know when they get drug or they don't get drug. And it's really important because we have something called expectation bias. And there's a whole bunch of things that lead into the narratives around all of this, like we've discussed, and that contributes. It's new. It's kind of something that, you know, is almost a secret in some people's imagination that this recreational drug could be used for something therapeutic. Mm-hmm. So there's all of this expectation that goes with getting it. And so when you're lucky enough to get it, you think to yourself, holy cow, I should be better.
Yeah. So I would suggest that these are primarily open label studies.
Yeah, the idea that they're the ones that at least try is reasonable, but we're going to...
Yeah, for sure.
But they're really like... And if you remember the cannabinoid research, James, it was actually, you know, coming right up to being funny about it. Like,
yeah, yeah.
When 90% of not only patients...
Yeah, but the nurses and the investigators.
Caregivers, the nurses can sort out when someone's got it. And one of my favorite studies is the patients who were regular users of cannabis could actually sort out not just that they were on a cannabinoid or a placebo, but they could also sort out whether they were on the high or low dose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So these are not blinded trials. They're run as blinded trials. As the infusion is going, you don't know, but the second that
it kicks
chemical into your brain, you know. Yeah. And then if you look at response response for ketamine versus midazolam, what you'll see in that case is much more response from the control arm, the midazolam arm, about 26 to 29. But another 21 to 26% get better on top of that. So if you've got, you know, 25% getting better on midazolam, you get another 25% or 50% total getting better on ketamine. If you look at this, the numbers are small again, 126 to 296 patients. And again, it's only really working at day 1 and 7. The longer term, like 2 and 4 weeks, not statistically significant.
Yeah, and I don't, I've never really looked at it, but do you know the evidence base for midazolam for depression? I mean, is it? No.
It was used as a
placebo that would do something that was similar to ketamine.
Yeah, you'll see when we talk about psilocybin, they give all sorts of stuff. Low dose psilocybin. My favorite is they gave niacin to make you feel weird.
Yeah,
and then So
in other words, the true placebo is likely the 26 to 29 because they think they're getting something, and then we're adding another 20 to 25% absolute on top of that.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And then the last one from the Cochrane review that I think needs to be summarized for response is S-ketamine versus placebo. Now, you'll note we were talking before about kind of 100 to 200 to 300 patients. In the S-ketamine studies, 2 to 6 RCTs with 450 to 1,100 patients. Mm-hmm. So a lot more patients and followed for longer. So their differences are, interestingly, the placebo response was higher here. Again, this is a nasal spray. It's used kind of 2 to 3 times a week. And as you get stable, you start to taper off to using it even only once every 2 weeks. And it's often by that point, though, you're taking 2 to 3 sprays at your one dose for the next 2 weeks or so. And just to be clear, wherever it's authorized or approved, there's an expectation that even with nasal S-ketamine, you're expected to be in a physician's office when you use it. Mm-hmm. It's a restricted substance. So you go into the physician's office, you use your 1 to 3 sprays. Each one has a 5-minute window between each spray, and then you hang out there for 2 hours afterwards. It's just important because some people might be thinking, well, S-ketamine, they just take it home and use it like any other antidepressant, but it's not that. It's actually controlled. So let's get back to the numbers. So it's, again, 15 to 44% responded to placebo, and an additional 9 to 15% more than that responded to S-ketamine. So if you like, imagine maybe 30% of people respond to placebo in these S-ketamine studies, and then 40% to 45% respond to S-ketamine. So it's that kind of 10 to 15% better absolute numbers than placebo. Now, we always talk that there's two things you have to know, right? You have to know what's your chance of responding, what's the responder analysis, but how much can an average person expect on a change in scale? Mm-hmm. So that is measured, unfortunately, in many of these with a standard mean difference. We will get to what it actually means in some of the studies, individual studies on a MADRS score. But the standard mean differences for ketamine versus placebo early on is 40.43 to 0.87. So James, you'll know that those are pretty big numbers. What might that translate to? That's like a 35% improvement in scale. Mm-hmm. So a pretty large improvement for an average improvement. Ketamine versus midazolam, not quite as big, but still quite big, 0.37 versus 0.57. Again, these are probably pretty, like a 25% improvement in scale would be a guess. S-ketamine, the average change in scale is actually quite a bit less. The standard mean differences are 0.21 and 0.31, so smaller.
But I still think the most useful numbers are the number of people who responded.
For sure.
And that's how that's reflected of it, yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of, so how do we actually understand these numbers a little bit better? So what we did is look at some second meta-analysis. So this is a study of S-ketamine for treatment-resistant depression. There are three RCTs with 700 patients. And the spray is a 28-milligram spray, so you can get 1 to 3 sprays, so 28 to 84 milligrams, 2 times a week for 4 weeks. MADRS was greater than 28 in these patients, or greater or equal to. And if you were, the placebo moved you 14 points, which is a lot, 14 points. But S-ketamine moved you 18 points down on the scale. So you went in the placebo group, you went from 28 down to 14. And in the esketamine group, you went from 28 to 10. That difference is about 4 points. Somewhere between 3 and 6 is considered the minimal clinically important difference. So the average person is getting a minimal clinically important difference, or right at the borderline, over what they get with placebo.
Yeah.
But you can see the placebo response is still fairly robust.
Yeah. And then I think, as I'm sure you know, there's also the response data. So we actually have the numbers of the people who
respond. Yeah, so the responders, to coincide with that, mm-hmm. is 33% with esketamine versus 22% with placebo. That's a number needed to treat around 9.
Yeah. So we're looking at about a 10% change, which is actually very similar to many other antidepressants. Now, absolutely. This is not necessarily for treatment resistant depression, but
Exactly. So this is a little bit better for that subgroup, mm-hmm. but still not dissimilar to what you can see with some antipsychotics and other treatments for this. And then there's all sorts. We're going to save the adverse events a little bit for the next podcast, kind of talking about that. But others found the same, a MADRS change of somewhere around 3 or 4 better than placebo. And I think one of the big take-homes here is all the talk about these drugs being kind of a cure-all and fixing, and like it was, this has been held back, and it just shows that medical science doesn't, you know, want to get people better. All of those kind of things are some of the things you might hear in social media and some internet sites. But when you look at this data, 2/3 of patients are still not responding, even in the esketamine arm.
Yeah. And it's so important. And I think as healthcare providers, if we have an appreciation for placebo and how much they respond and often how many people don't respond, it's so important because it really helps you ground your decision making or the discussion.
Yeah, you need to know how many are responding and kind of because again, if you just read the media, you would assume this was a cure all.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And the reason is because if you have one person who responds, they will tell you it was a cure all.
Yeah, for sure. And even if you look at the very best data for ketamine, which as I've said to you is at much higher risk of bias. Mm. At best, 50% are responding in those, even at the only short time points. So it's not working for everybody. It is working for some based on this data, but it's not working for everybody. And I think that just bears mention because it's not what we're seeing in the media.
Yeah, no, for sure.
So we've just talked really about we're going to summarize now because we've gone a long time in this podcast. We've talked a lot about the background of this drug, and we've talked about how the media portrays it. We've talked about what the actual benefits are for the responder analysis from the best available data. We gave you a Cochrane plus a couple other systematic reviews. In the next podcast, what we want to do is talk about how long does it work for, what happens when you stop using, how would you compare it to ECT? What are the adverse events, and also some of the costs and risks of long-term use, which we don't know as well yet, but we don't want to let too much out of the bag.
No,
so that will be our next one.
Excellent. So nothing else then, Mike?
No, that is all, James.
Great. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.